This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Moore. I've seen a lot of inner city poverty over the course of my years working as a death investigator. It's part and parcel of what you do. And you have to understand that it's many people's reality. People say that they know what it's like to be poor, but there's being poor and then there's impoverished. Kind of a hopelessness sets in. As I'm speaking to you right now, I'm looking at a photograph. It's a photograph of a home, an abandoned home, in a rough neighborhood, in Toledo, Ohio. And there is scribbling on the wall, graffiti, if you will. And around the home, there are also balloons that have been placed there to form a small memorial for a young lady that is no longer with us. And just let me tell you what the graffiti says. It says, "You let them silence her. CSB, where's your accountability? Her life mattered." I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Dave, there's just some of these cases that really tug at our heartstrings, and this is one of them. There are varying degrees of horror with this case. It's, you know, the old adage about going down the rabbit hole. It's like the deeper you go down the rabbit hole, it's a descent into Hades almost, with what happened to this young girl. And I'm talking about a young lady. She's 13 years old. She's a child. Her name was Kamani Lateague, and she's from the Toledo, Ohio area. And to say that she had had it rough growing up is certainly an understatement. We cover cases like this regularly, but I think that it's very important that every time one of these cases comes up, we need to talk about it, because this is the real stuff that's out there. This is what, not just adults, this is what children are going through right now. And boy, did she wound up paying a bill that she did not owe to anybody. And it is pure hell.
Kamani Lateague, you mentioned, is 13 years old and is missing. That's when her story begins in terms of the media. And whenever you have a child missing, the first thing you do is nowadays you look at the home, who was in the home, who lived there, who did she live with. Now, in Kamani Lateague, her life situation, she lived with her grandmother, Dorothy, and Dorothy was her, Kamani's primary caregiver. And yet her mother, Kamani's mother and father, biological father, were both involved in her life. But to what degree, we're not entirely sure, because you never know who to believe in any circumstances. But Kamani Lateague at 13 lived with her grandmother, Dorothy, and her grandmother worked overnight. Her grandmother went to work 10 o'clock at night, got home at 6 in the morning. And that's kind of, we've got a couple of different stories like this, okay, that where a girl goes missing or a young person goes missing. And I'm going to be honest with you, at 13, a child is a child, and they're not old enough to be left alone overnight. No. You don't leave a child alone overnight until they're old enough to drive. And that's just, and by the way, that's just a Dave Mack rule. And
no, even I agree with you.
I just have a real problem with this. I know others feel differently, but I'm just saying that's how I think. But in her case, and I know I always hear whenever I say something like that, you don't understand the circumstances. Yeah, I do. I do understand the circumstances. And I will tell you, you can make good choices whether you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter. Good choices don't have a price tag. If you're going to be held accountable and responsible for a child, then, and you've accepted that responsibility, you owe it to the child to make sure that you're taking care of them. And there are no excuses that I'll buy. It's just, it's a personal thing. But
no, I agree with you. And personal, you know, the thing about it is these choices, there's, you know, it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, you plugged in economics to this. And I'm thinking, well, that investment in making good choices, you reap dividends in the end. And this is where, in my opinion, everyone failed as child. All up and down the line, you know, from what I have gathered, given her background, there were multiple reports of potential child abuse involving Kimani. She allegedly had marks on her body that were viewed. There were teachers that had alerted the workers at child welfare services. And by the way, that comment about CBS, that was scribbled on the wall outside of this home, which we'll talk about in a bit. That's actually the acronym for the local child welfare services.
Right. And but look, Joe, from the very beginning, the story begins with her going missing, and whatever happens after that, this is one of those stories where we're covering it because it needs to be covered. People need to know this happens, but this is a new low. Every time I think we have mined the bottom of the pit, we end up with another shovelful. And here it is. Kimani Lateague goes missing, and her grandmother, Dorothy, comes home from work, and it's just the two of them that live in the house. They do have a dog, but just Kimani, 13, Dorothy, grandma. Kimani's grandmother sees her the night of March 16th when she's leaving to go to work that night. When her grandmother comes home from work that morning of March 17th, Kimani is gone. So her grandmother immediately starts calling around and notifies police, because when she comes home, the door is unlocked. That's not a normal thing. The house was in disarray. Not a normal thing. The stove was on and she could smell gas. Not something that would normally happen. Kimani's keys and glasses were still at the house, but the girl can't see without her glasses, Joe.
Yeah.
So Dorothy knows this is something really bad. Dorothy even had this comment about the gas being left on. She said, other than her and I, it's just two dogs in the house. So who cut it on? Talking about the gas. So that was kind of suspicious. Her glasses and her underclothes were by the couch in the front. Her pajamas were on the dining room floor. Now, pay attention to what she's saying there. Her glasses in her underclothes were by the couch in the front. Her pajamas were on the dining room floor.
Yeah.
What does that tell you about what she was wearing, Joe?
Well, obviously prepped for bed. If we're talking about PJs, the fact that you've got a young teen like this is highly unusual. You know, you can't envision them, you know, bouncing about the house nude. Not that you would want to, but the fact that she's apparently naked and wandering about the house is disturbing. She's already gotten ready for bed. I would think that, you know, as an investigator, you would ask the question, well, is it normal in your household for this 13-year-old girl to disrobe in the living room where perhaps they could be seen by a passerby? Anybody could, you know, perhaps walk in. Is that something that is normal? Then you would want to look, and as troubling as this might be, you would look at the clothing to see, well, maybe she had an accident. Maybe, you know, she wet herself. Maybe she had, some type of intestinal problem. Or maybe she's injured in some way. Is there any remnant of blood on the clothing, you know, the underwear, the PJs? Because you're talking about two separate locations. You're talking about the PJs being in the adjacent area. And then you're talking about the underwear near the sofa. And with the sofa, one of the things you're thinking about, if this child is absent her underwear, are we thinking about a sex attack here at this point in time? Where the perpetrator, assuming that this is a male, had disrobed her, made her disrobe, or had ripped her clothing off and then assaulted her there on the sofa in the living room. There are a lot of people that sleep on their sofas, okay? There are a lot of people that do a lot of other things on their sofas as well. But, you know, this scene in and of itself would have been perfect to go in and examine for trace evidence on that sofa, try to understand, first off, if there's any biological substances. And one of the things I'm thinking about, or two of the things I'm thinking about, are obviously blood and any kind of seminal deposition. We've got two females living in this home. And according to the grandmother, they are single occupants of this home. You would not expect to find, say, remnant of semen, you know, on the sofa. If it is, I've got a lot of questions. Was the grandmother involved with anybody? We wouldn't think that a 13-year-old would be involved. I'd want to know, again, examining the underwear, was there any kind of deposition within the underwear relative to this as well? So this would have to be handled very, very carefully. Also, within the house, I know that you had mentioned, Dave, that the door was open, but we don't really know if there was a sign of a forced entry here, do we?
No. And here's the interesting part. There's a lot here. A lot to unpack, as you say, or as Nancy says. By the way, the reason we mentioned Nancy, it's Nancy Grace. That's who we're talking about. That's how Joe and I got to know one another, by being on her show. And I work on her show on a daily basis as I do Body Bags, something I'm very proud of the work we do, because I think we're making a difference at how people consider watching after children in particular, which is why every time we do a story about a child, a 13-year-old that goes missing, I feel like I'm more aware of the children in my neighborhood. I'm more aware of their schedules now. I am more than I was a few years ago when my children were of that age, because now I know what's normal in my neighborhood, And in this case, what we know that the door was unlocked. That is not a normal occurrence. They kept that door locked. So that's a start. Now, we don't know if there was forced entry, but we do know a few other things. We know that the home was in disarray. This is also something that Dorothy said that was not common. And you can think about this. Dorothy is as a grandmother, teaching her 13-year-old granddaughter how to act, how to behave, how to keep your house in order kind of thing. I can see that, if it was in disarray, this would be an unexpected occurrence. And the gas being turned on, the stove, there was a reason for that. And we don't know that reason. But what we do know is that when she goes missing, there's no sign of Kaimani anywhere, and the media is there to cover it. And so Kaimani's father, her biological father, is there to talk about her. And he goes on TV, Joe, and he is begging for somebody to share information. His name is Darnell Jones. He also goes by Darnell Ogletree. Darnell is 33 years old, and he is on local television in Toledo saying, please help find my daughter. But what we find out, Joe, is that on that night of March 16th into March 17th, when Kaimani was home on March 16th, her grandmother saw her when she left for work. Well, Darnell Jones says he got a call from Kaimani, and she said she was scared being left home alone. Would he come over? And so now we know that Darnell Jones went to that house and took a friend, and he says they stayed there until about 12:30. That's from her biological father, Darnell Jones.
Let's unpack it a little bit. Here we are using that term again.
Yeah.
One of the things that stands out to me relative to this door that we had mentioned, if it is not forced open, many times when you see a home where maybe there's been, to call it a home invasion is not necessarily accurate, but when you have a door that has not been knocked off the hinges, or that the, you know, that it's been kicked in adjacent to the doorknob, you're thinking, well, somebody had to open it from the inside, or was it ever locked at all to gain force entry? Well, what do we think about that? If you and I, let's just say our kids show up at the house, okay, our door is locked. You know, I can look out my front window. I see when Noah arrives at our house, and eagerly I hop up and go and lock the door and open it for him, you know, because I'm happy to see him, right? And I don't, there's no threat there, okay? I'm not talking to him through the door. Can you please verify for me your ID? Right. So one of the first things that's why we always talk about force entry and struggle. Now, I don't know that we can classify this, and I would beg you to please use the term that the grandmother used one more time. What did she say about the interior of the house? That it was what?
It was in disarray.
Yeah.
Meaning it was a mess.
It's a mess. And here's a term that I don't know if you've heard in a while. The old guys used to use it that trained me. They love to use the term rifling, and I'm not talking about ballistics. They would use the term like rifled through objects or personal belongings, or generally it applies to like paperwork, and you know, people are rifling through things. You know, when you talk about in disarray, is it a purposed disarray where maybe you're using the items in the house to threaten somebody with? Maybe you're throwing things, or can you frame it like drawers being open and things tossed out because you're looking for valuables? You know, it's a completely different way of looking at it. You can get this, I love the term menacing. And how easy would it be? Think about it. When you were 13, how easy would it be for an adult to have menaced you? Being a death investigator, I'm given pause sometimes to think about where my physical body will wind up. And I'm not necessarily talking about at a funeral home or in a graveyard. You have these moments in time where you think, well, might I die in my bed? Might I be behind the wheel? Might I be at my desk and suddenly struck by a heart attack or a stroke? I can tell you what's not on my bingo card. It's not a burned out house, abandoned, burned out house with windows boarded up, the vinyl siding on it curled because of the intense heat that ravaged the place. That's not what I'm thinking. And I can tell you this, when Kamani was born 13 years ago, nobody was thinking about that, I can guarantee you. But Dave, gotta tell you, brother, that's where this angel wound up.
You know, when her dad went on TV and said, I was here. She called. She was worried that some man was trying to break in, or somebody was trying to break in. You know as well as I do, when the police heard that, ding, 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 radars went up. He's now put himself in that house during the time we know she was taken.
Yep.
Because we know grandma was there at 10 on the night of the 16th. When she came home early morning of the 17th, Kamani was gone. And now we have dad on local TV saying, yeah, I was there till about 12:30 with a cousin of mine. We stayed there. Now, as a father, I can't even identify with any situation with this. But as a man, would you ever leave a 13-year-old child afraid of being left alone? Could you possibly leave at 12:30 at night with your 13-year-old daughter saying she's scared?
Hell,
I don't know a real
man that
would.
There's no way
under
the sun that I would do that.
So okay? Do you think the police bought that?
No, of course they didn't. And it just doesn't hold water. You know, if it's me, and I can only speak to me, all right?
Right.
If sure. I've got a 13-year-old daughter who is, you know, sitting there shaking, and she's afraid that a man, Dave, implying a grown man,
exactly,
is threatening her or after her, do you think I'm going to pedal myself out of that driveway and leave and not take her with me? Or at least, hey, baby, you go get in your bed. I'm going to sit here on the sofa. And if you need anything, you just come back in here. But I'm going to stay here until your grandma gets back. You know, what else does he have to do at 12:30? We've already established he ain't at work. We do know that per his girlfriend that he had muddy work boots. But you know what she says? She says, and this is a statement that she gave later, kind of burying the lead here, but she's like, he hadn't worked right. And I don't know how long.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like his dance card is full for right. the next morning. All right. So you're telling me, the universal you, not you, Dave Mack. You're telling me that your boy just rolls out of there with a frightened 13-year-old daughter, and grandma is still what? If she's working mids, she's going in at 10.
Yeah.
Or 11. She ain't getting off until 6 or 7, and then she's got to commute back home. That's what you're trying to tell me, dude? I'm not buying it. I'm just not buying it.
And the thing is that, you know, immediately when grandma gets home on the 17th, they immediately begin looking for Kamani. They're looking all over the neighborhood because, again, you're not going to jump to every conclusion in the world. You're going to try to make sense of this somehow. And they spent the entire day of the 17th going door to door, friends, neighbors, community members did a search. They did a complete search of the area before actually reporting her missing. And she was technically legally reported missing on the 18th.
Hey, was the dad involved in the search for her?
Yes. Yeah, he was. That's why he was on TV right away. Please. I was there. She was afraid of it. See, he was already staging it when he's on TV. He's there saying, I was with her till 12:30 because she was afraid somebody was trying to break in. So immediately, we're not burying the lead by telling you that he's the guy we're looking at. But here's what actually happened, Joe. They found her body. They found her body in a horrible place. And you're going to have to describe what condition she was in when they found her. Because I've looked at it and I'm trying to figure out, how does one make sense of what happened to this missing 13-year-old? Because between the time that we know she's missing and the time we find her, there's no, you know, you're not getting a letter in the mail, you know, with a ransom saying I need $20,000 and you'll see her. We're not getting any of that. We're not getting pictures holding her. I mean, she's missing until she's found. And when she is found, she's found dead. Now, how did they find her? What condition was her body in? It boggles the mind at what we're just going to have to describe. Yeah, it really does.
And let me give everybody a warning here, because we're going to talk about and I know that sounds weird here on Body Bags, but I've got to tell you, there's a term that judges use many times, and it's called this so shocks the conscience of the court. And this shocked me, you know, when I heard about the nature of this case. I can't think of one right now, even though we've had a lot of over-the-top cases with a lot of forensics that, you know, would make your blood chill. But, you know, that's one of the ways we make it through it as investigators, is that, at least in my sense, is that I try to look at things scientifically. Dave, it's hard for me not to look at this as a dad. It really is. It makes me sick to my back teeth. And
I do want to add one quick thought.
Yeah.
Before they found her body.
Yes.
The police had already identified that her biological father, Darnell Ogletree, that they wanted him for kidnapping. They had established that based on what he had said, based on what they had pulled together. And so they were trying to find him then. He'd already been on local TV saying, help me find my daughter. And now he's our suspect. And they charged him with abducting her before they found the body.
Yeah, they charged him, but with kidnapping, they didn't have him. What we do have is Kimani. And they, when she is found, as aforementioned, this, it's a two-story, give you kind of the rundown. It's a two-story dwelling, in this particular neighborhood. It's gray in color, and it's got vinyl siding. And if you've never been to a fire scene, when vinyl siding is involved, what happens is that, it gets so hot, the exterior heat, you know, the heat that's being given off from inside, it's like laying plastic on a, you know, on like a, an oven surface. It curls, and that's what the vinyl siding does in this particular case. So it kind of curls up, and you see this, just kind of further paint this picture. You see it's smoke, with the remnant of smoke and charring that you see at the top of these windows downstairs. Now, these windows have been boarded up. They've been boarded up because this house is probably an eyesore in the community. It's, gone through a fire. The fire was knocked out. You see this kind of scoring and, staining of smoke at the top of the window. And what's going on is it looks like this fire, whenever it did happen, started on the bottom floor, because the top doesn't necessarily look as bad as the bottom. And so as fire licks out of a house, it's trying to get to the highest point so it can grab oxygen and consume it. All right. It's eating oxygen. And so many times when you go out to house fires, you'll see this. I can only imagine that when they made their way into this house and they got up on that second floor landing and they began to look around, I can almost guarantee you there was a foul odor. There was a foul odor. And that's really hard to separate out, because if you've ever been around a fire, like a bonfire, or maybe you've had the unfortunate circumstances of having a house fire, that smell is rather pervasive. But the one thing that will trump that smell is decomposing bodies. You can get an idea. And then when it's commingled and blended, I don't know how much they were able to actually appreciate at the scene. But when they found her little broken body, they discovered that she had almost been completely decapitated, because she had multiple incised wounds. I can go into that. But the one thing, or the two things, that were missing are those elements of our anatomy that even when we're babies, we're exploring the world around us with. You see, in the case of Kimani, someone had taken the time to not almost cut her head off, to completely cut both of her hands off. The ME, when they did their exam on Kimani, they determined that her cause of death, Dave, was going to be these injuries to her neck. Now, these are sharp force injuries, but they're not stab wounds. Okay. These are incised wounds. Okay, and
you're going to have to explain the difference, Joe.
I'm
picturing in my head.
Yeah. The knife, if you just think of a knife, knives are inserted. That's a stab wound. If a knife or sharp object, sharp instrument, sharp weapon, it's called sharp force injuries. If that blade is drug across a surface, that's an incised wound. Okay. I'll give it to you in the most simple terms. If you've ever, like myself, the idiot at large here, was ever cutting up, I've done it many times on onions because I get careless with them. I want to put as much distance between myself as possible and them. As you're cutting them, I've cut my fingers multiple times. I've cut myself in the morgue, Dave, even through my glove. And this happens a lot, generally with a scalpel blade, but they're always, I've never stabbed myself. I've always cut myself. So these are incised wounds. That means that the surface, the leading edge of that surface has been drugged or pressed into the underlying tissue. And so it creates these very, very neat, what we refer to as neat margins, because you're talking about a milled edged weapon that it's not going to be jagged. And a little primer here so that folks will understand, many times we will get out onto the scenes and we will see individuals that have been beaten to death and they have lacerations. People in the emergency room abbreviate that and they call them LACs, L-A-C. It's a laceration. Make no mistake, a laceration is not a cut. A laceration, in the purest sense of the definition, comes about as a result of blunt force trauma. And so you will get these weird looking jagged injuries where the skin literally rips. Okay. You'll get injuries where, you know, I even think about like press contact gunshot wounds to the head where the skin expands and you'll get that stellate presentation, which looks like a star. That's actually a laceration because the gas is expanding the skin. That's not what Kamani had. Kamani actually had incised and apparently multiple incised wounds, and they're not just It diminishes the injuries that she sustained to her neck by saying that her head was almost cut off or she was almost decapitated. Dave, to go through what we refer to as full thickness, if you're talking about, you have superficial injuries that happen with knives, and knives in particular, where you're talking about full thickness, most of the time, doctors, forensic pathologists, when they use that term, that means that it will go through the full thickness of the skin, the epidermis, the dermis, down through the subcutaneous fat into the muscle. So that's like a full thickness injury. If they're saying that she was almost decapitated, that means that he had gotten down to the bony structures with the sharp instrument that he had used. And, you know, the first thing I'm thinking about is the cervical spinal column, that he couldn't go through it because probably all he had at his disposal was a knife. Now, I don't know that for certain. There could have been other things. But one of the shocking things, relative to Kamani's case is that both of her hands had been cut off. Now, I've had cases like this, and I was actually in a great presentation one time many years ago. This is, you know, you file this under how stupid are criminals. The guy's body was actually found in a creek, and he had been both decapitated. They never found his head, and both of his hands had been cut off. The idea that investigators came up with, well, they did that in order to either delay or prevent the guy's identification, you know, because you don't have teeth at that point and you don't have hands to do prints with. The idiot that killed him and did this to him left the guy's wallet in his back pocket. And so even though the case that was being presented, I'm listening to this and I'm, you know, my mouth is wide open, I'm listening to this. Even though you didn't have the head and you didn't have the hands, they were still able to get him identified. And I'm thinking, well, in Kamani's case, why would this sadist, not Satanist, sadist, and I'm using that term because there's a sexual component here, why would this individual cut the hands off? Are you doing that in order to inhibit or impede, rather, I guess, is the authority's ability to get her identified through fingerprints? Well, does she have fingerprints on file? Do you know something about that? I mean, she has been a child that has gone through the system. Did local family children services Did they ever print her for anything? Are you thinking that, do you think that you're going to thwart this investigation by merely removing this 13-year-old's hands? Is that where we're at with this? Because I don't understand the rationale behind it. Were you going to try to piecemeal out the body and you were merely going to this abandoned house? And here's another thing. This house, Dave, and the doors, well, maybe not necessarily the doors, they've been boarded up as a result of this previous fire. You can see kind of that particle board, cheap particle board that's used to cover windows after fires. And they drop screws in there, you know, to cover the windows to prevent anybody from, because it's dangerous. I mean, burned out houses are one of the most dangerous environments you could be in. Well, you have to think whoever the perpetrator is had a familiarity with the area. They would have gone directly to that house. Maybe they had seen it in the daytime passing by. Did anybody see somebody carrying this young girl's body into the house? And then how did you gain access to the house? And it's not just like this is done on the first floor. Once they made entry into the house, they went to the second floor to do this. So had they been hanging out in here before? Did they know that the staircase was safe? It's one thing if you're going to try to walk yourself up a staircase in the dark in a burned out house, but now you're going to take the body of a 13-year-old and walk up the staircase with that body and then do whatever it is you're going to do with that body upstairs. I don't know. There's a lot of questions here from a forensics perspective, Dave, that right now we don't have the answers to.
We don't know. And that's what I was going to ask you. Okay. They would obviously know, they being the investigators, when they're doing the autopsy, they're going to be able to determine that her hands were cut off after she was dead. They're going to determine.
Oh, yeah.
That, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And yeah. And so you're going to be looking for hemorrhage in there. If there's no hemorrhage, there's, you know, then that's an indicative of a postmortem event. This is something.
And they haven't described whether or not this is the location. Like, was she killed at this location or was she killed somewhere else and brought there?
Yeah. And there's a lot to consider here as well. I find it very interesting. Can we go back just a second to her home?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about the gas being on.
I am too. That's exactly. I'm in the same boat because my first thought was, okay, wait a minute. We got a burned out house here where her body is found on the second floor. And I believe that whoever kidnapped her, whoever took Kamani outside of her grandmother's home, set that gas on to blow the place up to ruin any other evidence he left behind. And that's my thought.
Another thing I'm wondering. I'm wondering if there were, if the individual had thought about that, had they lit candles in the house in another area, hoping that as the gas kind of filled the environment, that it would ignite off of candles burning in another area of the house. Now that's a methodology that arsonists have used in the past. And it seems as though that there's this weird connective tissue with this case in the gas. And back to the gas, before I get too, my brains get too scrambled here. I was thinking when her body is examined with, if it is a carbon monoxide asphyxiation case, let's just say that she was around this gas that was seeping out into the house and it's displacing the oxygen. She takes on carbon monoxide, just the opening of her body. We've kind of talked about how it, carbon monoxide affects the hemoglobin. You'll see it automatically that soft tissues will have a cherry pink appearance to it. Even the blood will be cherry pink. And I'm wondering, was this like a half-hearted attempt at that, you know, and it just kind of, you know, just kind of played out. It didn't work out like they thought that it was. It seems highly disorganized, to me. I don't know that there was necessarily a plan going in.
Right.
Well, but Dave, I'm going to go ahead and mention this. And it it just absolutely breaks my heart as if this is not, if the fact that what makes this all the more tragic is the fact that this child was raped. And as you, my friend, have famously stated, and I agree with you categorically, children don't have sex. Children are assaulted and raped, period. And she was, in fact, raped. They have performed a rape kit on her, Dave. And it, you know, it bore fruit relative to the fact that they knew that she had been sexually assaulted. You're talking about a very impassioned event, twisted and rotten to the core, but still being driven by passion, by somebody that saw an opportunity for this 13-year-old girl that had been left at home alone while her grandma was going out and making a living where her parents were not around. The mother had famously stated that, yes, she would go with her father. I guess the grandmother gave permission. And, you know, you and I were talking about this off air. Anytime you hear a comment like that, you know that the grandmother in this case would be the primary custodian, that right. Something has happened that has been identified, that these two adults that brought her into this world were, for whatever reason, incapable of taking care of her on a day-to-day basis, Dave.
And a couple of the things that we've got to get to very quickly, Joe. I'm very curious because you mentioned earlier that it was Darnell Jones / Darnell Ogletree. Same person, just different names, which yeah. anytime a person who's 33 years old has two names they go by,
yep.
immediately I'm thinking, really? I don't know anybody other than professionals in radio and television, you know, people who change their name for that. I don't know people on the street that use two different names to go by unless they're criminals. But I'm not saying that Darnell Jones / Ogletree is a criminal. I'm just saying I don't know anybody that has two names. But his girlfriend was the key to this case. But let me ask you this, Joe.
Yeah, bud.
We know that the night of the 16th, Dorothy, the grandmother, leaves to go to work. And we know that Kamani is at the house. We know that Darnell Jones went there that night, claims he was there till 12:30. We know that that morning when Dorothy got home on the morning of the 17th, that Kamani right. was gone. Now,
yes.
Kamani's body is not found for 6 days.
Right.
Her body is not found for six days.
Yeah.
And it was on, I want to break down what the girlfriend says here. Now, Darnell Jones' girlfriend at the time helped police find the evidence in the murder case. She told investigators that Jones called her on Friday, March 21st, and asked her to turn the cameras off at their home.
Oh, boy.
Suspicious, she left the cameras on. This is the 21st. This is 4 days after Kamani has been taken from the home.
Yeah.
And a couple of days before they find her body. So on the 21st, he says, turn the cameras off. She leaves them on. The girlfriend says that she saw him move items from his SUV into the house and hide them under the basement stairs. Girlfriend calls police. They get a search warrant. They come in and they take the evidence. The girlfriend told a reporter that he hid a mat like you have in the back of an SUV, that rubber floor mat.
Right.
She said that he put the rolled up floor mat and his work boots that were caked with mud. That's where I mentioned you mentioned how you hadn't been working. He put these under the stairs in the basement. And she says that once Jones noticed, when Darnell Jones noticed that those items were gone, meaning she calls police, they came, they did the search warrant and got those items. When Jones came in and realized those items had been taken, he bolted. She never saw him again. So he takes off. He knows they got the evidence that's going to. So now I'm going back to the girlfriend says that Jones calls her from Columbus, Ohio, and she told police where they could find him. OK, but Joe, a couple things here. He's got a rolled up. We know that she was found on the second floor of a burned out house in Toledo. We know that he's hiding evidence from his SUV under the floorboard on the 21st. 4 days after her kidnap.
Yep.
Did he have her somewhere?
Wow.
And was raping and terrorizing her for days before he then killed her, allegedly, and put her body on the second floor of this burned out house? Is there a way to determine yes. when she was killed?
Yeah, there is, hoping that the medical legal community did their due diligence at the scene, because it would be a matter of being able to examine her body, what we refer to as in situ, which means a fancy term for in place. So let's just think about this. If she has been down for, we're going to get into a little entomology here. If she has been down for, say, 6 days, okay, in that location, then there would be a, flies come to mind. There will be a fly cycle that goes through where you have adult flies that come in and lay eggs, and those eggs go through the various stages they go through. You develop the larva, the maggot. Maggot sheds the husk, becomes, you know, an adult fly, and then that cycle kind of continues on. And one of the things we do at scenes is we collect those husks. We collect flies, by the way, as well. Generally put them in little containers with alcohol in them. Just the entomology alone is going to give you an indication of, was this 6 days or was this 2 days? You know, had he been riding around with her in a truck trying to decide what to do with her? We get back to the fact that there is a partial dismemberment here. And I always hold that if an individual is going to engage in that practice, you need a lot of privacy, because it's a matter of, first off, not knowing what you're doing anatomically. Do you have the right tools? Are you using some kind of blunt tool that is not sufficient to the task? I go back to the idea of the hands. Were those hands removed on the surface of that mat? And it was just kind of like, and this has happened before, Dave, we have people that will enter into this idea that they're going to dismember a body. And then all of a sudden they realize they stepped off the edge of the pool and they're in the deep end and not the shallow end. And it's too much of a burden to undertake, because you don't have the correct skills in order to engage in this. You don't have the right tools, and you just suddenly, you know, maybe you get both the hands. The hands would be the easy part. The hands and the head would be the two easiest parts to those elements of the body to be removed. Out of everything else, in my estimation at least, feet at the ankles are complicated. Okay. Hands and head are simple. You get through here and it's, you know, it's, there's a term that lawyers use. Nancy's going to jump on me for this, because you're not a lawyer, Joe Scott. There are offenses that are labeled. It's an incomplete offense. They call them inchoate offenses. This is like an inchoate act, you know, where you set about to dismember a body, and then suddenly you realize that it's too much work. I can't do this. I have to find some place to hide this body away. You bring up another interesting point, Dave. Had he been holding her somewhere else, torturing her? Now, would there be other evidences of that? Well, when we think about, you know, the different things of torture, you know, they're involved. I've had people that were branded, that were tied up, cigarette butts put out, you know, crushed out on them, chemicals poured on them, and whatever kind of insult that you subject the living person to at a cellular level, you can actually appreciate that the body begins to try to heal itself. Okay. Some injuries begin to recede. You'll see the body almost trying to stitch itself back together, if you will. Okay. For lack of a better term. Is there evidence of that? Is there evidence that early on that she had been traumatized in some way in life, and that she had been kept alive, and that these injuries were starting to subside? They're not as inflamed as, say, the initial insult. that's certainly something that the ME would have to explore. And I'm sure that they did, you know, because they're looking at these injuries. Now, they're saying that the injuries on the neck, which is, they famously said that this is a almost complete decapitation. They had hemorrhage in those areas. So that means that she was alive and had her throat cut. They also say that she has been sexually assaulted. Okay. Now, with that said, we begin to think about that this is who the police have identified. This is her daddy. It's her father. Her biological parent. I don't, it's hard to plumb the depths of this. And this does happen. It happens a lot. We don't know what kind of trauma she sustained during the sexual assault at this point. We don't know if this was an event that was, again, antemortem. Was it a postmortem event? And it's hard to make heads or tails of it. I do know this, and I would love for you to kind of lay this out for us. He apparently did not have the intestinal fortitude to personally deprive us of his presence, did he?
No, and I mentioned earlier that it was his girlfriend. Thank God she has character. You know, she's the one that called police and said, this is wrong. Something's going on here. Come, you know, without her, we would not have a lot of information that we have. And by the way, the other part of this, you know, the reason we know about her hands being cut off, the rape, and the fact that her neck had been, that her head was, that she was nearly decapitated. You know, the Toledo police chief is mad about that because it was a spokesperson for the Fraternal Order of Police that actually gave that information to the press.
Boy. Yeah.
And it didn't go through the Toledo police chief. Yeah. And he's mad because he said, you don't say that out loud in public because you don't know what the family knows or where the investigation stands. So while that information is accurate, you don't give that out. I was shocked we had that information. We've never had this before.
Yeah. And so, I think I've read like 8 articles on this case, and it mentions it in every single case.
Because it's so shocking. And anyway, when the girlfriend, they were looking for Darnell Jones, Ogletree. They were looking for him. They couldn't find him. And it was his girlfriend that found out where he was, and she called police. So they knew where to go in Columbus, Ohio, to go and get him. When they go there, they know he's armed. I'm going to assume, and that's a horrible thing, but they knew he was armed somehow. I'm going to assume that the girlfriend said, you better watch out, he's armed.
Right,
because
right.
he had communicated with her what he had planned to do. And when the police arrived with SWAT, by the way, this is all in video. SWAT team arrives.
Is it? It's a body cam, right?
Yeah, body cam.
Yeah.
And SWAT body cam. And they actually, they get him. He wants them to kill him. You know, kill me.
Doesn't he say that?
He actually makes that request
kill of me. Them.
Yeah, kill me. And they wouldn't. They shot him in the one place that they knew they could probably save him, you know? And that's what we know. This information has been really given to us in a very quick amount of time. Usually you have to wait for reports and things like you know, before lawyers and everybody else for the cities involved usually go through these things. We have to beg for them and file FOIA requests. Not this time. And I'm thankful from our standpoint of getting the information, Joe, but I wouldn't be thankful if I was a family member and didn't know what happened. The other day, we were actually in the middle of a show, and we had family members on the program that knew information that was not public and that the police had not given to us yet. And I heard them say things that I hadn't heard. And it was shocking, but they knew it. The family knew it.
Right.
And anyway, same thing. It's a here in reverse. The family might not have known all the things that went into this when they released the information to the press. So bottom line, this girlfriend gave the evidence. She knew something was wrong when he said, turn the cameras off. She's the one that called police. come and get it. It's right here. So they could get a search warrant and know exactly what to look for. Then she calls and says, I got him. Here he is. And they went and got him. And because they knew his state of mind, that he was wanting to die, they prepped accordingly and didn't kill him and took him into custody, where he'll now be held accountable.
Yeah, he will. And, you know, we'll see what the prosecution does with this. We'll see what the courts, you know, what they allow. A lot of this data is already out there. I don't know. I mean, prayers for her family that remain. Grandmother, my heart breaks for her, Dorothy, in this particular case. Kamani's mother as well. Dorothy was the one that was tasked, you know, with her well-being. And now this is something that's going to haunt her, I can guarantee you. And I hate that. I really do. It's a tough world out there. You got to get out there and make a living. And that as a grandmother, you've been tasked with taking care of your grandchild is, you know, it's something that happens every single day all over this country. No 13-year-old should be subjected to a life of abuse, neglect, sexual assault. And we don't know if this was the very first time this had occurred. But what we do know is that the world has been deprived of a beautiful young girl who died in a horrible way and was discarded like garbage. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.